Alfredo, this is the longest I've been away from the Paradoxes class since 1988, when I went to visit six countries in southern Africa. So I spent 11 days in Japan and 3 days in North Carolina with a couple of days in between. They gave me a couple of days in between because in North Carolina I was doing a debate, and they were concerned that with 11 hours of jet lag, I needed a little bit of time. So I actually convinced the people in North Carolina to put our event on at the very end of their conference rather than at the very beginning. And I am very grateful for that because there's no way I would have been ready having just flown back from Tokyo. But what I wanted, you know, what's interesting about these past 3 weeks is just the opportunities we had to talk to church pastors in Japan about developing an adult education program. And you know, this church is unusual in that we have as many adults involved in Sunday school classes as we have in worship service. That's not typical of churches in America. You know, I had an opportunity to deal with Southerners when I was in North Carolina, but also the Japanese, where most of the focus in the church is on the worship hour, not the classes. The other thing we're discovering is a lot of churches have adult classes, but the adult classes are organized like many worship services. And, you know, what we really appreciate about this church is how the classes are structured to emphasize teaching, interaction, discovery, rather than just simply emulating another worship service. So that's part of the fun I get in traveling around the world, is just sharing with other Christians and church leaders that there is a different way of encouraging adult education. So it's instructive for believers, but not just believers, but providing an opportunity for people to bring people who are not yet Christians to learn and discover and explore the Christian faith. But I also want to share with you some things I've learned from these travels about what I think we can do better here in America. In many respects, the Japanese Christians are doing things in a way that puts us to shame, and we need to learn from them. And also, what was really fascinating about my debate in North Carolina is how we were able to take the very topic what we've been discussing these past few weeks in Psalm 33. So, you know, towards the end of the class, I'll actually show you a little piece right from our teaching of the past few weeks that I was able to use in the debate. And I got it on PowerPoint now, which I think might be helpful for us to appreciate the things. But we're just getting into that part of the text when I left on my travels. So that will be kind of, I'll give a little report, ask questions as you wish, and then we'll tie into our lesson in Psalm 33. So that's kind of a quick outline of what I'm going to cover. Now, what I'm going to do first is show you a slideshow. Now, the slideshow is distorted, and that mainly I was taking photographs when I wasn't speaking. So you really don't get to see a lot of the action at the ministry events, a little bit, but not much. Mainly I'm taking pictures when I'm in the train and so forth. But I did get to take some pictures when I was doing debates because there's another speaker. So you'll see a little bit of that. So I'm going to show you this slideshow, and it's going to be just 4 seconds each photo, so it's going to go fast, and then I'll give you a little description of what was taking place thereafter. Let's see. Well, that's my entire collection. Don't get nervous. No, yeah, the wedding pictures are not in here. Okay. I think we need to get the displays detected. Okay. Let's see if this works for you. Okay, this is Osaka where I flew into. This is the outer suburbs of Osaka, so it's quite crowded, even in the extreme outer suburbs. We're about 40 miles from the center of the city. That's Venus and the Moon up there at night. And that's the bullet train that we took in our travels. And this is the countryside as we're going along the bullet train. We're getting the very end of the blossom season. So the Japanese love their blossoms. And this is a typical graveyard with a statue of someone who passed on. This is a castle. They just kind of build one story on top of another. No. Those are now kind of museums. But a few more of the blossoms there, and that's a gravestone. Japan's 80% mountains, so wherever you go, you're going to see mountains. Rice fields, I had to get a rice field shot in here. So, and this is on the way to the southern island of Kyushu, and that's the bay where you see three of the major islands together. And this lady here is Japan's most famous folk singer. She's just become a Christian and consented to sing in our event. That's my translator, Tim Boyle, and a couple of our volunteers. That's the train that's faster than the bullet train. That one goes more than 200 miles an hour. We had a cheap fare, so we didn't go on that one. More of the countryside, a small village, and again, even in the villages, the homes are jammed very tightly together. One of the few churches we saw in Japan dates back, that's a Catholic church dating back quite a ways. And another one of the classic Japanese castles from the era of 200 and 300 years ago. This is a gaming parlor, which are everywhere you see these adult gaming parlors. Not that it's R-rated, just that you get millions of adults playing there every evening. A couple of the long-legged quadrupeds that are easy to tame. These are exceptionally easy to tame. Japanese deer, I mean, you can get within nose-touching distance of them. They won't move, as you can see. Yeah, they're very friendly to one another, too, as you can tell. Yeah, these are wild deer that you can just go up and touch. They're very, very tame. And these are just some shots of the city of Nauru, which is their most famous Buddhist temple site. And there's just Buddhist temples everywhere. That's my translator taking a photograph. Very clean, yes. And, you know, at one point my translator left his camera, came back, and was still there. So, a lot of white-collar crime in Japan, but they're very honest about people's you know, all these buildings are in one area between Osaka and Tokyo. And this is approaching the oldest and largest wooden structures in the world. This building here is in fact, the very oldest and largest wooden structure and houses all these idols. It goes back to before 700 A.D. And so that's all the original wood. I guess not. I mean, that statue is made entirely of wood. And it's about 40 feet high, just that one. And that's not the biggest by any means. It's a warrior that's guarding the Buddha. I mean, you'll see the shot of the Buddha in a minute. Yeah, the one shot of me. Now, this is the building that's the biggest wooden structure in the world. And inside of it is this huge statue of Buddha. Second largest statue of Buddha in the world. Made of bronze. And these are some deities on either side of the Buddha. And even they are enormously large. And the beams that support this building at the base are about 7 feet in diameter. So they must have used some amazing trees to build this thing. That's another one of the rained a little bit, but one day it rained hard. And that is the world's largest gong. And it's made out of brass. And that shows you how big it is. That was a fellow's a missionary whose home we stayed. And you can see how they ring the gong with that big, huge... here's Tim getting a picture from underneath. And that's the picture he took. And there's the thing that rings the gong. Well, they have it tied up so people won't, so tourists won't ring it. But they, every couple of days they'll ring, and it really has an unusual sound. But yeah, the thing they use to ring it, it's 8 inches in diameter and 15 feet long. And those little cedar slats you see there, all those, they have written prayers on them. People write their prayers on that thing and stuff them in there. They refer to them as prayers to the non-existent God. Well, they don't really believe in a personal God, but they do believe in prayer, which is weird. If God isn't personal, why bother to pray to Him? Well, I don't know. These are lamps, which they light at night. And you can get your fortune told here, either in Japanese or in English. I know, that's about $2. Well, they give you this little vial, and really all it's in, it's the equivalent of a message you get in a fortune cookie. So it's cheaper to buy a fortune cookie. That's the one shot I got, well, a few shots I got here of Mount Fuji from the train. Train was going at 185 miles an hour while I took the shot. And you can see, but because Fuji, and this is a classroom I taught at in a university in the Tokyo area, University of 20. This is a humanities class, mainly dominated by young women. And this is the campus, and this is a Christian university. 20% of Japan's university students are enrolled in Christian universities. And that's the chapel. I got to speak at a chapel. Chapel was required. All the students have to go to chapel once a week and take two classes in the introduction to Christian faith. This is Tim Boyle, my translator's PowerPoint, which you can see was resting on the Word of God. And I was able to go. These are the hosts that took care of us while we were in Tokyo. They're both missionaries. She's from Okinawa. He's from the States. And this is just something we took at the airport. We got to the airport a couple of hours early. So, and this is our North Carolina event. And our volunteers from Orlando, Florida, drove up to manage the book table. And this little lady here, she's in her mid-90s. And she's doing a number. Well, if you go to Reasons to Believe office, the quilts you'll see on display, they're all done by her. And this is the audience for the debate. There are a little more than 900 people that attended the debate. And you can see they kept very close watch on our time. That was a 15-minute introduction. And that's Danny Faulkner, who was debating, and these are the two moderators. Okay, that's it. That's the slideshow, just to give you a little flavor of what it was like. And, I went to Japan from LAX, but had to fly up to San Francisco because I was going into Osaka. They don't have flights into Osaka from LAX anymore. And it's a 12-hour flight because they use a slow plane to go from San Francisco to And I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting to get there in 8 or 9 hours, but it was a 12-hour flight. So I was a little bit exhausted when I got off the plane. My first engagement in Osaka was to speak at the Osaka International Church. And I'll send you around a little bulletin that you can look at. And it's in both Japanese and English. And these are the churches that are proving to be the least offensive to Japanese nationals. One of the reasons we've committed to go to Japan, this is actually my sixth trip to Japan, but the thing we noted many years ago, even before Reasons to Believe got started, is that if you work with Japanese students from Japan who are studying in the United States at universities, either as graduate students or undergraduates, we were finding that we were able to bring about 7 out of 10 of these students to faith in Jesus Christ. And yet the number of Christians in Japan, evangelical Christians, is a little bit less than 1%. And, you know, why is it so high when Japanese students come here and so low over there in Japan? Well, my first trip to Japan, I discovered that the primary reason why Christianity hasn't been more successful in Japan is the church. The church is the biggest barrier for several reasons. Your typical Japanese church is very anti-scientific, anti-intellectual, and highly feminized, which means it's virtually impossible to get, quote, the Japanese salaryman to come to church. That and the fact that Japanese salarymen work a lot longer hours than we do. And so, trying to have them take some time off on Sunday to go to church is a sacrifice that most of them are not willing to undertake. And we found that very early on in our ministry in Japan that we were going to have to work with the non-traditional Japanese churches, not the traditional. By the way, the traditional Japanese church has one man in it, the pastor, and about 30 women. And usually the 30 women are young and single. And so it makes it very difficult for a Japanese salaryman with a family to go to church. His wife immediately gets suspicious. And the fact that the teaching is so highly anti-scientific and anti-intellectual, makes it difficult for someone who's, say, an engineer to go to such a church. So early on, we began to work with these international churches. And it wasn't just because it was easy for the translation. Actually, it's not. Because you have people coming to these international churches who really don't know much in the way of English at all. And then you got people who know English that don't know much in the way of Japanese. And therefore, we have to do everything in two languages, Japanese and English. Because the English don't understand Japanese, and Japanese don't understand English. But the difference is that these international churches don't have the same problems. They have about a 50-50 mix of women and men, and they tend to be not so anti-intellectual and anti-scientific. In particular, traditional Japanese churches are staunchly young earth, and my first visit to Japan, I've never been so rudely attacked in my entire life, and it was by native Japanese, which was a real shock to me because, you know, I heard that the Japanese were polite, but they called me things I've never been called before in my life. I won't repeat them, although I could repeat a few, like false prophet, they called me that, tool of Satan, those are a couple of the nicer terms they used to refer to me. So, yes. It's usually about a 50-50 mix. There's 50% will be people who are not native Japanese, and 50% will be native Japanese. So in that sense, it's a good mix. But it sort of restricts your ministry to the large cities, because it's only in the large cities that you're going to have a significant number of expatriates. This trip I was in Fukuoka, the largest city in Kyushu, the southern island, Osaka, and Tokyo. And so in all three of those cities, there were significant international churches. And the beauty of the international church is it provides the native Japanese with a cover. Because what we discovered early on in our ministry in Japan is that men in Japan are very embarrassed to be exposed as being interested in the Christian faith. If their friends find out they're interested in Christianity, they immediately think, well, they're either chasing women or they're into this anti-intellectual, anti-scientific pursuit. And so they try to hide the fact that they're interested in the Christian faith. But these international churches provide a cover. They can say, well, I'm not going to church to learn about Jesus Christ in the Bible. I'm going to church to make business contacts and learn English. And so at the beginning, when you go to an international church service in Japan, it doesn't start off with music or prayer or people shaking hands and introducing themselves to one another. The first 10 minutes are devoted to exchanging business cards. And people are making contacts. And it's basically to provide a cover so that native Japanese will feel comfortable coming. And all these international churches have classes in learning Japanese for the expatriates and then for the Japanese how to learn English. So there's language classes going on all the time. That provides them with a cover. The other thing we learned as soon as we got our website up and running in the Japanese language is just monitoring how many Japanese hit our website. And it's number two in the nations around the world in terms of hits on our website. So it tells us there's lots of Japanese coming to the web to learn about the Christian faith. And once again, they can do it in total secrecy. Nobody knows what they're doing. So it's a private way. And, you know, and frankly, I appreciate this because when I was studying the Christian faith, I kept it a complete secret from everybody, including my own parents, for 2 whole years. I didn't tell a soul what I... Because, again, I was in that same spot. I would have been terribly embarrassed if my friends or my parents found out that I was reading the Bible. So I read it in complete secrecy and I studied the Christian faith in complete secrecy. So in that sense, I've got some empathy for these Japanese who need some kind of cover. And that's what these international churches are doing. Well, I spoke in the largest international church in Osaka a few hours after I arrived in Japan. And it was the largest church meeting I've ever spoken at in Japan. There were about 300 people. And you say 300, that doesn't sound like a large church. In Japan, a church of 300 is a mega church. Again, your average church attendance is about 30. And if you've got 100 people coming to your church, you've got a mega church. And so 300 is kind of like a super mega church in Japan. But what was fun about this event is half the people that were there had never been to the church before. So we were talking to a lot of unbelievers, a lot of guests, and we had a Q&A time afterwards, and that went well. And this, in my opinion, was my best trip to Japan, thanks mainly, I think, to technology. Because we worked it out in advance that in every event I would do, we would do PowerPoint projection. Not like here, we would set up 2 screens. So it would be 1 PowerPoint in English and another PowerPoint in Japanese. And it had the advantage of making things easier for the translator. Because the translator, having the PowerPoint in advance, could prepare what he thought I would be saying. Although I did catch my translator off guard a few times. And by the way, my translator is an atmospheric physicist who's been a missionary in Japan for 25 years. I really couldn't get a better translator than Tim Boyle. At one point he said, Hugh, there is no word in Japanese for calibrate. Would you please stop using that word calibrate? I said, well, a couple of my talks is very difficult not to use the word calibrate. And he said, well, you know, every time you use it, I'm going to have to take it. And it was literally an entire paragraph he had to give to define the term. And I said, well, how do Japanese scientists do their science without referring to calibrate or calibration techniques? And he says, well, they have to come up with this entire paragraph. He actually talked to some research scientists. Surely by now, and they said, nope, there isn't. There's no word in Japanese for that term. Just like there's no word in Japanese for God, there's no word in Japanese for sin. So when you're trying to, and by the way, in Japanese, the words that they have for the fundamental forces of physics are the same words they use to attach to different species of wild animals. So you always got to tell the audience, although my translator says to the audience, Dr. Ross is now talking particle physics, he's not talking biology. Or if it goes the other way around, he's now talking biology, not particle physics. So they know which one, which definition to go with. So, and in the past, I've noticed that when translating, say, English into Chinese, you lose about half the time. A one-hour message has got to be squished down to 30 minutes. But in the past, when I've spoken in Japanese, I had to divide by 4. So if it was a one-hour message in English, it would now be cut down to just 15 minutes of content that I could give. You know, trying to give a significant talk on science and the Christian faith and scientific evidences for the Christian faith where you only got 15 minutes to get across a message to a technically trained audience where they, you know, they have all the technical background, but you got to cut corners. I mean, you're shaving it down to 15 minutes. Thankfully, I didn't have to go to that extreme this time. Instead, we were dividing more like by 3 than by 4. So it was fun to be able to get a little more content into my message. And but that was thanks to the PowerPoint and having them both English and Japanese. And by the way, I might someday actually show you what it looks like on the screen. It's kind of fun having the two languages up there. Because, you know, you have a little English word up there and the Japanese equivalent goes on for quite a ways. But that was church in Osaka. And then after that church and the Q&A time, which I think was one of our more productive events because of the number of unbelievers that came, we caught a bullet train and went down to Fukuoka, which is kind of on the north tip of Kyushu. If you remember your Japanese geography, you got this huge island. I should have a map up here. That would help. But you got the biggest island is Honshu. That's where Tokyo and Osaka are, and Hiroshima. And the train we took went through Hiroshima, which, by the way, is completely built up now. They've only got a little tiny area left where the atomic bomb hit that they've preserved. And then you go about another 100 miles, and you reach the south tip of Honshu. Then you go through this long tunnel, about a 25-mile-long tunnel that goes underneath the ocean floor, and you pick up the island. And close to the other end is this large city. And actually, it's two large cities. There's two large cities of about 1.5 million people each, 3 million total in that area. So I spoke there that evening, and that's where the... And by the way, that lady who is Japan's most famous folk singer, she showed up totally by surprise. And just says, hey, you know, I brought some relatives with me, and would it be all right if I were to start the service with a song? So everybody knew her. We had to do it. So, and they extended our talk, and we had a nice Q&A time afterwards. And the next morning, spoke to a group of pastors. They pulled together pastors from all over the two cities. And I had a chance to talk to them about science and the Bible. That was my most requested talk. I had 8 talks prepared, but that was the one that people wanted over and over again. And the reason why is there's a perception in Japan that science and the Bible are completely contradictory. There's no way you can integrate the two of them. But it was really fun just showing these pastors how they can be integrated. They said, how come nobody ever has done this before? And I said, well, I'm not the first. It goes all the way back to Isaac Newton and King James I. King James I had a chaplain, and the chaplain wanted to write a book on science and Genesis, and that chaplain consulted with Isaac Newton and came out with a commentary on the Genesis creation accounts and science at that time. But it's very close to what we teach in this class. So it's not new. It's been around a long time. And by the way, I came up with my interpretation strictly on my own. I had no idea it was the same, roughly, as what Isaac Newton came up with in King James. And by the way, that's happened throughout the past 300 years. So why not earlier than that? Well, earlier than that, science wasn't advanced enough for people to realize there was any possibility that they could be brought together. Only in Isaac Newton's day had science advanced to the point where that was a useful apologetic approach. So it was fun for the pastors to hear. Number one, this is not brand new. This is not unique to Reasons to Believe. And then they all wanted the PowerPoint so they could teach it themselves in their churches. And that was really a breakthrough for us because, as I mentioned, this is a way we can penetrate. Because all these pastors were from these typical churches where you got 30 young women and one male pastor, and kind of a young earth perspective. And incidentally, the approach with getting them past the young earth thing is what we're doing here in the class. There are 25 major chapter-length creation accounts in the Bible. And, you know, the way to properly interpret those accounts is to integrate them all. It's not enough to take the Bible literally. We have to take it literally and consistently. That's kind of a message I kept hammering to pastors in those three cities, is that, yes, if you take the Bible literally, you can possibly come up with a young earth interpretation of Genesis 1, but not if you try to integrate it with the other 24 creation accounts in the Bible. And believe it or not, that was really novel to these pastors. Oh, there's more than one creation account in the Bible? They thought it was just Genesis 1. And that's what they have been taught, that all the answers are in Genesis when it comes to creation. And just to hear that, no, there's all kinds of other creation accounts. There's even three creation accounts in the Bible that take you through the events of the six creation days in more scientific detail than Genesis 1. So that's an obvious appeal. Before you develop an interpretation of Genesis 1, at a minimum, you want to integrate Genesis 1 with Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, and Job 38 and 39, like we're doing here in this class. So in that sense, I think we've achieved a breakthrough we've not been able to achieve in previous visits, getting to these pastors. But that only happened, well, actually happened back in Osaka as well, because we drove back, or we took the train. You don't want to drive in Japan. It's very expensive. About every 2 miles, there's a toll booth that charges you the equivalent of about $10. So the trains are actually a little cheaper, and they're not all that cheap either. Life's expensive in Japan. They make more money than we do, but they have to pay out a whole lot more than we do. The purchasing power is nothing like it is here. But got on the train, got back to Osaka, and that evening spoke at Yodagawa Christian Hospital. And throughout Japan, you have these Christian hospitals. Now, we have Christian hospitals here in the States, but they're not as Christian as they are in Japan, if I could excuse the term. And we got Arcadia Methodist here. We got a Presbyterian hospital in Glendora. And I've had the misfortune of having to spend some time in both of those hospitals. And, you know, what happens is you get a chaplain that visits you that doesn't believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And I said, this is a Christian hospital, and, you know, I'm having to witness to the chaplain. So, but it's different in Japan in the sense that, number one, the best hospitals in Japan are Christian hospitals. And you pay the same rate to be treated at a Christian hospital as at a non-Christian hospital. And the hospital I spoke at in Osaka was rated the number one hospital in the entire Osaka region, and number 8 in the entire country. And the ones that are ahead of it are Christian hospitals. And so people do everything they can to be treated in a Christian hospital. It's hard to get into those hospitals because everybody wants to be treated there. But the thing that impressed me is each one of these Christian hospitals has built within it a large lecture hall. And, you know, what I found at Arcadia Methodist is they have this little chapel that holds maybe 15 people if you really pack them in. But what we had at this hospital in Osaka was a lecture hall that could seat 150. But in addition to that, the lecture hall was outside this very large foyer. And the foyer is for patients and gurneys. And so what happens is that, you know, and by the way, that lecture hall is used exclusively for evangelistic lectures. They bring speakers in to give messages there. And the doctors, the orderlies, and the nurses are invited to come, as well as any patient that wants to come. And the orderlies will actually wheel them out of their hospital rooms in the gurneys into this big area outside where they have a screen and a rebroadcast. So they actually have a little closed circuit TV inside the auditorium. And when I spoke there, there was probably about 200 people in the auditorium, 150 seated, 50 standing against the walls. And there was, I don't know how many outside in the foyer, literally at least 100 patients, perhaps more. And they had two special patients because they made a request to actually get inside the auditorium. You know, here is this one Japanese man. And he had tubes all hooked up to him and IV and stuff dripping into him. Everything was plugged in. But he had a notepad, and he was writing furious notes and asked good questions afterwards, and, you know, in Japanese, of course, but translated. And these are unbelievers. And most of the hospital staff, and, you know, the lead doctors are all Christians, and the lead administrators are Christians, but the rest of the hospital staff typically are not Christians. And it's but the hospital makes a real effort to reach out to the nurses and the doctors who are not yet believers, but as well to the patients. The other thing that impressed me is not only do they have this lecture hall and this large foyer and this program of bringing in lecturers, and by the way, my translator has spoken there several times, and that's mainly because he's on the board of trustees. He speaks there about once a month. And But in addition to this lecture hall in the foyer, they have a whole wing in the building that's devoted to evangelism. They have the offices of four chaplains there, and unlike the chaplains that visited me when I was in the hospital, these chaplains actually believe the Bible is the Word of God. So, and they go around talking to people about their spiritual needs, praying for them, and if they want to give their lives to Christ, and then they'll lead them through that prayer. But not only do they have offices in the evangelism wing, it's loaded with materials, books and Bibles and pamphlets and courses. A lot of patients will actually take courses. And the theme here, once again, is that the Japanese are embarrassed, typically, for their friends to find out they're studying the Christian faith. But if you're in the hospital with a serious condition, it's like they give you a break. Okay, we understand you're in the hospital, you're in a serious situation. The fact that you're taking a course on Christianity, that's completely acceptable. We understand why you might want to do that. And so these hospitals are set up. That's what they do to the patients. They get them taking these courses while they're in the hospital. And they want an extra day to finish the course, they give them an extra day to take care of it. So what I'm sharing with you is I think our Christian hospitals here could really take a page from what's happening in Japan. You know, we should be doing the same thing. And you know, I really was very blessed with what I saw and said, we got to take this back to the States. This is something that could be of great benefit. Because once again, I can tell you from my experiences in the hospital, that's when nurses and doctors and other patients are very receptive to hearing about the Christian faith. I think I told you, when I was in the hospital getting my heart surgery done, there was actually a lineup outside of my room, people wanting to ask questions. Mainly nurses and doctors, but also other patients would come in and say, hey, you know, I got some questions I want to ask. So, but that just tells you that in that kind of environment, you know, spiritual issues are right on people's minds. And we should be taking advantage of that, and we're not doing that here in the United States, at least not in the Southern California area. So that was a real blessing, and that was the first time I ever got to speak in a hospital. And I said to my translator, look, when Reasons to Believe speakers come over, this is where you got to put us. You know, it's great to get into the universities, but we need to do more of this hospital stuff. And Tim says, well, they've just put me on the board, and I'm connected with all the other hospitals, and he's going to be able to make that happen. So that was good. And then that same day, I spoke at Osaka Bible Seminary. And I'll send this around. This is their little pamphlet. You can see what it looks like. It's rather a large building they have and staff. And what they're doing is training Japanese people to become pastors of churches. And we stayed in the home of the guy who is who founded the seminary. And he says, unlike what the pastors are getting taught, we don't teach them the young earth perspective. We teach them systematic theology, integrating the entire Bible. And he says, we're committed to get the new pastors in Japan past this anti-scientific, anti-intellectual stance. So I look at Osaka Bible Seminary. It's the biggest seminary in Japan, as probably the key to the future of the church in Japan. But if you want to take a look at it, I want this back, by the way, but if you want to take a look at it, feel free to do that. And then we left Osaka area for Tokyo, and most of the pictures you saw in that slideshow were taken from the train as we were going from Osaka up to Tokyo. We actually got off the train for a couple of hours. I had 2 hours vacation while I was on this trip, and that's when I took those photographs there. But, you know, my Japanese hosts were great in that I said, look, I got to run every day. And Tim set it up so we stayed in places where there was actually some kind of trail that I could run on. In fact, I showed you one picture by a stream. It's a four-mile-long path that goes by this river. But everything's paved there. I mean, the idea of running on a dirt trail, forget it. There are no such things. They're all paved. So my knees came back with a little bit of new pains I didn't have before. Arriving in Tokyo, the first thing I did was speak to two humanities lecturers. And you saw the photographs of them. They were lecture halls that could hold about 300 students each. And the university is called Aoyama Gakuin University. And it's actually got several campuses spread out over the Tokyo area. Each campus has about 20 to 25,000 students. And unlike your typical Japanese university, this is a Christian university, and unlike your typical Japanese universities, they actually have what looks like an American-type campus, where you got grass and trees in addition to a bunch of buildings. Your typical university setting is where they have a bunch of high-rise skyscrapers jammed next together, and all you got between them is a sidewalk. But this had kind of a campus feel. And I told my translator, look, I've never seen a campus like this before in Japan. He said, well, this is a Christian campus. And the Christian campuses actually have places where students can sit under a tree with grass and read and study and talk. And the students love that. That's one reason why these universities all have a waiting list. But they also have a waiting list because their faculty are of such outstanding quality. Christian universities, unlike the Christian hospitals, they insist that all their professors be Christian. Some of them are expatriates, but if they're expatriates, they have to be very fluent in Japanese, because all the lectures are in Japanese, but a number of the professors are native Japanese. And they take the full range of courses. Again, this is where I think our Christian universities could learn from what's happening in Japan. Because, you know, your typical university that's a Christian university here in the States, they're usually a four-year college with some limited graduate program. But these universities were real universities with a number of graduate students, not just focusing on the undergraduates. And unlike Christian universities and colleges here in the States, they offer the full range of courses. So, for example, one class I got to lecture, it was engineering and science students. 300 engineering and science students came in. And it says, oh, this university has an engineering. It says, yeah, we have all the engineering disciplines. You can take electrical. You can take mechanical. You can take, chemical, civil. All the engineering programs, petroleum engineering, are all taught at these universities. Likewise, all the sciences are taught. And unlike universities here in the States, Christian universities, where they may have, say, one physics professor, one chemistry professor, two biology professors, no, they have an actual department of physics, biology, chemistry, with several faculty in each department, with research programs going on. And so, once again, it's like the Christian hospitals. These are recognized as the best universities to go to in Japan. And as I mentioned, 20% of all the university students in Japan attend these institutions. And, of course, with a nation that's only 1% Christian, the vast majority of the students aren't believers. But they do have to go to chapel once a week, and they do have to take two classes called Introduction to the Christian Faith. And a lot of them complain about the classes, but they said, you don't have to go here. If you want to go to a state institution, be our guest. And they said, well, we don't want to go to a state institution. Well, then don't complain about having to take the classes. And by the way, those classes are set up so that you can ask questions. You don't just have to listen to the professor. But that's difficult, I've noticed, in Japan, is trying to get the students to ask questions. They really just like to sit there and take furious notes. And, you know, it's... I also kind of felt for the classes. Here is addressing 900 students, 600 in the humanities and 300 in science and engineering, and every one of them was going to be tested on what I told them. And they actually had to hand in notes of my lecture at the end that they were going to be graded on, and then the next day they were going to be tested on the content of what I said. And I said, you know, I'm not sure that's the best environment to encourage these students to ask serious questions about what they've heard. They're so uptight about what they're going to have to do in taking notes and being prepared for a test. And I said, well, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, we should do things kind of the American way, where we actually let the students relax a little bit these ideas. You know, if you're going to require students to attend these classes, it'd be good to set it up in such a way that they can act. And I said, well, that's what the chapel's all about. So I got to do a chapel message, and again, that was really... Although the chapel message, they have got singing and prayer, it all built into the chapel, and what I really had to do is take my one-hour-long message and cut it down to... Well, I had 11 minutes, Well, I mean, I actually had 25 minutes, but in terms of how much content I could get across, it worked out to what I would normally say in English would be 11 minutes. So trying to find something really significant and impactful that you can get across in 11 minutes. My translator said I pulled it off, and he was translating faster than he's ever translated before. And we managed to finish right on 25 minutes. But that's the longest they've ever allowed any speaker to go. So, but again, I was encouraged just by... and by the way, we were having this lunch with the faculty. A bunch of students were outside trying to crash in so they could ask questions. So we know they want to ask questions. And after the chapel time, we had a really good time just fielding questions from the students. So that's the university scene. I got to speak twice at Tokyo University. And that's kind of the leading... That's kind of like... well, it's at the level of, say, an MIT. It's a really high-level science and engineering school. And that's the place to go if you want to get the most challenging education in science and engineering. And so I gave two lectures there on two consecutive nights. And it didn't draw a large audience. Again, we probably had about 100 to 150 come to each of the two events. But what was encouraging for us is one of those events, the audience was almost entirely senior graduate students and professors. So and then we had a lot of time, too. So I was able to get across a lot more content. And that's the first time I've seen that many faculty, because I've spoken at that university before. But to see that many faculty come out and found out that because I'd spoken there before, they kind of knew who I was. They heard about me from the students, and so the professors came out in large numbers. So, again, I appreciate that, because if you can impact the professors, they're going to get to the students. Well, I gave them three options. And so I told them I was going to be coming back the next night. So I actually let them choose the talks that they wanted to hear. And the first one they wanted, and this is the one where it was primarily graduate students and faculty, they wanted the one in science and the Bible, because they've been told it was impossible to pull the two together from a scientific perspective. So I talked about that, and the next day they asked me to speak about the origin of life and the origin of humanity, because I put quite a bit about the universe in what the science and the Bible want. Kind of what I do with science and the Bible is show them how the Bible teaches Big Bang cosmology, then how the scientific evidence makes it crystal clear that the Bible's version of Big Bang cosmology is the correct version. That's kind of my introduction. Then I kind of take them through Genesis 1 and show them how all the events there make a perfect fit with the established record of nature, both in the description and the order of events. So they heard that the first night. And the second night, we got into the origin of life and the origin of humanity. And the origin of humanity talk was popular in Japan because the best evidence for our biblical model on human origins comes from Japanese genomic studies. And that's because the Japanese are unique in the population groups of the world, and then they don't move. I mean, when you meet a native Japanese... they can trace their ancestry back about 10,000 to 11,000 years on the Japanese islands. They don't emigrate and they don't immigrate. Very few people move in, very few people have ever left. And so you have a very stable genetic population. And because of the great stability of the Japanese population, that's really one of the best places to go to test whether or not the human species has evolved genetically, and to come up with an accurate date for the first man and the first woman from whom are all descended, and to test that idea, the biblical idea that the entire human species comes from one man and one woman. That can now be done with genetic studies, but the best, the most reliable place to do that is with these stable populations. It's not the only one, and I told that to the Japanese people. I said, these conclusions don't just rest on Japanese data, because we've got other population groups that are similar, like the Jews, the Armenians. The Armenians move all over the world, and so do the Jews, but they maintain their genetic purity. And then an example similar to the Japanese would be the Finns and the Estonians. But there you're working with a much smaller population group. That's the advantage of the Japanese. You've got 127 million of them and a very little movement in or out. On the other hand, that kind of research probably within 10 years will no longer be possible. And that's because the Japanese have such a huge immigration rate right now. That's what's making possible all these international churches, the fact that people from around the world are going to Japan to work. And what that does is disturbing the genetic stability, because all these foreigners are coming in and they're marrying Japanese men and women. And so no longer is the genetic base going to be stable. And by the way, it's a worldwide phenomenon. Literally, within 10 years, we'll no longer be able to employ a genetic test for the origin of humanity. The research has got to be done right now, because population groups are intermarrying at a very rapid clip right now, and it's disturbing the stability of the genetics. Most of all, here in Los Angeles. This is the most mixed-up genetic place in the world. But Japan is one place where this kind of work can still be done and get reliable results. But, you know, the Japanese, unlike us, are extremely nationalistic. And they take great pride in anything that's, quote, Japanese, that's furthering world progress. So this message in human origins was very popular in Japan because it makes them look really good. So... And I found from previous trips, anything I can do to make the Japanese look good is going to get me a listening ear. And that's one reason why I wear long sleeve shirts when I'm speaking in Japan. That's to hide all my body hair. Because the myth in Japan is that the really intelligent people are the hairless people. And, you know, us Northern European types, we must be descended from the Neanderthals because of all of our body hair. So the fact that I got a bald head, that really scores well in Japan. Ah, the hairless one, he is wise. So as long as I don't show the rest of my body here, I'm fine. But that's a myth in Japan, that the Japanese are intellectually superior to all the other peoples of the world because they have less hair. So, yeah, believe it or not, they actually think that they're the most intellectually evolved of all the peoples of the world. Well, I don't know.
It all depends on the tribe.
Yeah. Well, I ran into that in Africa too, because the Africans don't have a lot of body hair. They have very smooth skin. And so when I was speaking there, they referred to me as the ape man. And that's when my translator there said, wear a long sleeve shirt. So it's more uncomfortable, but it's got to be done in that context. Well, I'm moving on. Let me just wrap this up here. I got to speak to several churches on Saturday and Sunday after speaking at Tokyo University. Did three churches in rapid succession. An evening church Saturday night and two churches on Sunday morning, and then I grabbed the plane ride home. But these three churches I did in Tokyo, again, were unusual. One was an international church, and two were not. But the two were not are being headed up by pastors who are not native Japanese. One was a Hawaiian, and one was a Korean. And, that's really working well in the sense that they're not encumbered by the culture of the Japanese church and can do things in a different way. And that's something I discovered there, is that if you're an outsider as a pastor, the Japanese kind of give you a break and expect you to do things a little more creatively. But one of the more creative things we did was I spoke at this Pentecostal church, and it's kind of fun listening to Japanese speaking in tongues. So they probably thought... Well, I couldn't tell, but I could tell by the way the service was organized what was going on. But I could also see that the guests were quite uncomfortable with it. And so I was just joking with some of the Japanese there that had never seen that before and said, well, you know, when I get up to speak, they're going to think I'm speaking in tongues too. So Now, if you ever bring Fuzz over here when he gets into his biochemistry, then it really is a different language. So, but what they did is they allowed me to have the worship service, and they purposely cut back their normal worship time, so I could have an extended time because we were translating it, and it was the longest service they've ever had. But then we had a lunch, and then after lunch we had an afternoon seminar. And what I noticed is all the visitors that came stayed for lunch, which was provided for the visitors at no charge, and they stayed for the seminar. And so I thought that was quite remarkable, getting unbelievers to, I mean, it was a 6-hour long event, but they enjoyed every minute of it, especially with the fact that they got to ask a lot of questions. And I let them ask me questions right in the middle of my talk, so I just stopped my talk and field questions. And apparently native Japanese had never seen that before, but they thought that was really a good idea. And the pastor went along with it too. He didn't call for the ushers to take him out of the church, so that was nice. And then, you know, coming back here to, by the way, I got to do one debate while I was in Japan, because after all, I mentioned to you, the church there is extremely staunchly young earth, and they heard I was coming. And the first time I came to Japan, the young earth creationist pastors were so disturbed, they actually got a posse together to try to get me on the next plane. Said, you know, we don't want you in our country. Get out of here. But this time they said, we insist on debating Dr. Ross. I said, well, this is difficult because I'm going to have to use a translator, and you're going to be speaking in Japanese without a translator. I'm going to have no idea what you're saying when you get to speak. And they said, well, we really insist on this. So they allowed me to speak for an hour since it had to be translated, which meant I had about 20 minutes of content. And they were supposed to have a 30-minute rebuttal, and then we were going to have a discussion with the audience. But the thing I noticed was the audience was predominantly pastors and Christian leaders. And it was organized by an old friend of mine, Timothy Himay. And Timothy Himay, some of you may actually recognize, he's been to this church several times. English Language Institute for Japan has brought him over twice to study church growth. And he actually spent a week here twice at this church studying the church growth principles that we inaugurated some 20, 30 years ago. And so I met him back then, and it was real fun. I had no idea he was the organizer of the debate. He said, well, I'm not the moderator. I'm just the guy who's invited everybody. But the audience, from what I can tell, was mainly made up of pastors. Probably two-thirds of them would have agreed with my position, a third with you know, Reverend Usami, who gave the rebuttal. But the thing I noticed is that he insisted that I speak first, and I was supposed to speak second, mainly because I knew I was going to be late getting from one church to this debate. In fact, we arrived 15 minutes late and said, look, guys, we told you we're going to be late. There's no way that we could get here. And we couldn't understand what he was going to say anyway. We just wanted you to give your thing. And he said, oh, no, I insist that you speak first. But what I noticed is that while I was speaking, he was changing his PowerPoint in rebuttal to what I was going to say. And then when he got up, instead of taking 30 minutes, he took 45 minutes, which meant we didn't have as much time for the questions and the discussion. I noticed that Tim Himay was really pleased with how it went. But what I found out later is after the debate, Reverend Usami called the guy who was going to be debating in North Carolina and gave him a blow-by-blow of what he could expect me to say when I arrived in North Carolina. And basically, that's what I did in Japan. I gave an abbreviated portion of the content I was going to give in North Carolina. But my perspective is, I had no idea that he'd found that he had done that until just before I walked into the debate in North Carolina. The guy who was opposing me, Danny Faulkner, did say about 5 minutes before the debate, by the way, I got a blow-by-blow from Reverend Usami of what happened in Japan. I said, oh, okay. And the same thing happened there. He was supposed to speak first, but when it actually came up there, quote, his PowerPoint didn't work, so I had to speak first. So basically the same thing happened as what happened to me there in Japan. But you know what? I didn't change a thing. I figured, hey, I got good content here. I don't care if he knows in advance what I'm going to say. I'm going to go ahead with it anyway. And so I did that thing. But the way it worked out is, and by the way, this is the most hostile audience I've probably ever spoken in my entire life. It was North Carolina, and I'll tell you who the sponsors were. I got them written down here. And by the way, I bring you greetings from Roger and Barbara Schwind. They drove from Illinois to attend the debate. And, well, they were going to meet some of their relatives that lived one state over. But they were excited to be there and actually helped out our volunteers who drove up from Florida to help out with the event. So they bring you greetings. They look healthy, and they're doing great. They say they miss all of you. But they also said that they thought that was the best I'd ever done in a debate in my life, so I appreciated the compliment from them. But, yeah, the sponsors were American Vision, Worldview Forum, Summit Ministries, and the Worldview Super Conference is where I was speaking. And there were two other sponsors. Vision Forum was there as well. Well, all of these sponsors are very staunchly Young Earth in their perspective. However, they had a super conference last year, and the most requested thing was we want a debate between Young Earth and Old Earth. And in fact, they told me that in terms of what people had requested in the way of information, they had a 4-to-1 ratio for the debate compared to everything else was going on the conference. So we drew a pretty good attendance. It was the best attended event at the conference. But they kept us in this green room, and I knew that there was going to be a preamble before the debate, and so I said to the guy who was had us in the green room, I think we ought to hear what the preamble is all about. And I said, well, I'll see if I can make that happen. Well, what I didn't know is they had three different speakers come up and give a preamble to the debate. I didn't hear any of it, but I'm really glad I brought Kathy along. She got to hear all the preambles. I didn't, but she got to hear them. So afterward, I found out what was going on in the preambles. And basically what was going on in the preambles is three different leaders of the conference got up and said, we want to warn you about what Dr. Ross is going to say. And here's the things we want you to look for. We want you to look for the different worldview he's going to bring to the table than what our speaker is going to give. And what Dr. Ross is going to do, he'll show you how he trusts science but not the Bible. That's where his worldview is going to come from. And notice the difference when Danny Faulkner speaks. Well, me, it was just as well I didn't hear the preamble because my entire talk was focused on, look, I'm in front of an audience that I already know in advance has very little trust in science. So I'm not going to put any science in my talk. All I'm going to do is put the Bible in my talk. Meanwhile, Danny Faulkner, his talk was primarily science. So, in one sense, the preamble helped. I mean, they were told, you know, look for this from Dr. Ross, look for this, look for this. And none of that happened. So, after the, by the way, the way it was set up is we were originally going to give a 45-minute talk, and then have an hour of Q&A from the audience. And they said, no way are we going to have a Q&A with the audience. For some reason, they were very upset about that idea. And I says, look, I don't think, they said, they're going to attack you. And I says, look, I've done this before. Says, I want to find out what the issues are from the audience. Well, they utterly refused. Said, that's not going to happen. And so what it really boiled down to is that there wasn't going to be a 45-minute long talk. So you get to speak for 15 minutes, then Danny Faulkner gets to speak for 15 minutes, then you speak for 25 minutes, he speaks for 25 minutes, then you can ask questions of one another, and then they also trim down the length of the time to just an hour and 35 minutes total. So it left very little time for a Q&A back and forth. Oh, and then Danny kept saying, well, you know, I don't really have 40 minutes of content. I'll just trim it down with longer Q&A. Well, he wound up speaking quite a bit longer than those 40 minutes. But thanks to my PowerPoint, I was able to hold exactly to the time limit. managed to finish each talk within 5 seconds. So you can do that with, that's if you've got a Macintosh. You can't do it with a PC, but you can do it with a Macintosh. So that's one reason why I use a Macintosh. But the thing that I felt was most unfortunate, and one thing I did emphasize in the talk is, look, if people can get away from their fear that this is going to somehow disturb the gospel message, we can get this debate resolved in a few weeks and get on to the next church-splitting issue that's got nothing to do with gospel doctrine. And that's been the history of the church. For 2,000 years, the Christian church has split over the non-essentials of the Christian faith. I mean, in the first century, as you see in Acts 15, they split over circumcision. Today, nobody bothers to dispute circumcision. But that's what they fought over in the first century. So this young earth, old earth thing I just shared with the audience is in the same category. It's not an important issue for salvation. If people would recognize that and let go of their fears, we can get this thing resolved. And when that happens, God will bless us with another church-splitting controversy that's got nothing to do with salvation theology. And says God does that because he wants us to learn how to resolve conflicts in a godly manner. Rather than all this hostility and dispute, he wants us to learn some principles from this book on how to deal with our divisions. So I think that scored well with a number of people in the audience. But after the debate was over, and by the way, we didn't get out of there until 1:30 in the morning. The debate started at 8 o'clock. And as Kathy and I were trying to leave the auditorium and walk back to our motel room, we kept running into little groups and wanted to keep the debate going. So, and thanks to our volunteers kind of spread out throughout the audience, and they were the ones that kind of kept the debate going, so we just kept joining these little debate groups as we, you know, go through one debate group and then move another 50 feet, run into another one, and eventually we got back to our room. But the next day, they devoted the morning's lecture series to refuting what I said in the debate. And I wasn't there. I didn't know they were going to do that, but they had three speakers get up. Each had an hour and 15 minutes, and they basically spent their time trying to rebut everything I was saying. And I mentioned that in the night before. I said, by the way, my introduction was this. I'm not going to talk about science because we know this isn't a scientific debate. We know it's not a scientific debate because no scientist, independent of a particular Bible interpretation, has ever concluded that the Earth is young or the universe is young. And I had some quotes right from Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris where they admitted on radio in my presence that they had never persuaded a scientist based on scientific evidence the Earth is. And I said, another, the other thing we notice is they refuse to debate me in front of scientists. They always want to debate me in front of laymen, but not in front of scientists. So I said, we know there isn't. It says if they had a scientific issue, they'd be willing to debate this in front of scientists. So I said, this is a biblical debate. It's not a scientific debate. And every time Danny tried to trap me into a debate about the science, that's kind of what he did. At the end of his debate, he gave a list of about 15 scientific evidences for a young Earth. And every one of them was complex enough that you would need, well, at least a beginning graduate education in physics and astronomy to see the flaws in his argument. So I just simply refused to deal with any of them. It says I've dealt with them in my book. Every one of the things he's mentioned is dealt with in the book that I wrote 2 years ago. And let's get back to the Bible, because that's where the real issues lie. But trying to make the point over and over again, this is not a Bible issue. Not a science issue. Okay, one thing Barbara and Roger said is they want me to take that 40-minute message and show you what I said here in the class. So I'll find some time to do that. I'll actually take you through so you get to see for yourself what happened at the debate. But it's an interesting experience. I'm not sure I want to go through that again. And by the way, yesterday, and I'll close with this because I know we're getting close to the end of the time here. Yesterday, I got to go to 2 homeschool graduation ceremonies, one here at the church and one at a church out in Altaloma. And the homeschool movement here is very different from what I saw in North Carolina. In fact, the joke at North Carolina is you can always tell a homeschool family because they show up at a conference in two vans. The smallest family I'd met there, they had 8 kids. The biggest was 18. So they have a lot of children. I mean, they're going to give the Mormons a run for their money. So, but there's also an arrogance there that I found quite disturbing, that because we are home educated, we are more knowledgeable and better prepared to deal with these issues than you people who haven't had that advantage. And I kept running into these homeschool, well, I mean, they'd be in their 20s, having gone through the homeschool education, going on to college. But some of them actually felt that they had a better grasp of astrophysics than I did. And I said, you know, I appreciate your homeschool. And in one sense, I said, I've got a homeschool education, too. Because, you know, I went to a public school. But I was so fascinated by astronomy, I self-educated myself at home in astronomy. And that was several hours a day ever since I was 7 years of age. So I said, you know, I don't want you to get this idea that, you know, I haven't been studying outside of school. And they said, well, yeah, but you had all that bias from your professors. And so, by the way, they did concede that I was a Christian, just a very deceived Christian, that I had been deceived by the brilliance of my professors. Well, I don't think my professors would agree with that, since we had a number of arguments throughout my education with my professors. But there is the arrogance here that I did find disturbing. Also, what I found disturbing is in the South, the homeschool movement very much is a fortress mentality, withdrawing from society, setting up their own institutions so they don't have to deal with what's going on in the outside world. And they protect themselves from all the conspiracies and the deception that are taking place out there. And one thing we're trying to do at the Mule Times is just say, the conspiracies you're talking about don't exist. And you would recognize that if you would engage society rather than withdraw from society. Well, the funny thing was, they had one speaker whose talk was called Engaging Secular Society. And I actually went to that talk and discovered all they're talking about, not engaging, they're talking about attacking society. There's a difference between engaging society and attacking society. And so I said, you know, rather than saying all these astronomers are out there to deceive you, why don't you try to win them to faith in Christ? And one thing that stunned a lot of the people there is the fact that I simply shared with them that in the discipline of astronomy, you'd be amazed at how many research astronomers are evangelical in their Christian faith. You know, how I went to MIT and the entire radio astronomy research group there, all 13 of them were evangelical Christians. All the faculty, all the senior graduate students. Arizona State University, the chairman of the department in astronomy there is an evangelical Christian. He's actually written articles for us at Reasons to Believe. But 4 of his top professors are also evangelical Christians. But because these people withdrawn from society, they have this idea that what's out there is a monolithic anti-Christian bias that's out there to destroy them. And I guess it doesn't help that we had that museum that went up just a few days ago. Most of these homeschoolers visited the museum before they came to the conference. So I don't think that helped any either. But hey, there's an opportunity to be a light in a dark place. I think it was tougher for Kathy than it was for me, because every time they found out who she was, oh, the enemy. So, says Hugh, I think you're the bad guy here. But we had some good times at the meal table, just showing people that we're not as evil as you think you are. Anyway, one sense, we're all evil, right? All of us are in need of salvation from Jesus Christ, and all of us are. In fact, I made that clear. It says, look, I'm not claiming to have the explanation on science and the faith. We have a model, and we're working to improve our model, and we want to, you know, keep learning and keep adjusting. But I primarily did that because what I saw in this worldview conference is that there really is no flexibility to adjust their interpretation no matter what they discover and learn. So it's that rigidity that I again found quite disturbing. Anyway, let me bow for prayer because we're out of time. And what I'll do next week is kind of start off with this little thing that I did use in the debate straight from Psalm 33. I think it'll be fun for you to see. Father in heaven, I want to thank you personally for the things that I was able to learn, both in Japan and North Carolina, that could be a benefit to the ministry here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church and at Reasons to Believe. And I pray, Father, that if there are any additional insights that we can use to help, that you bring that to mind. And, Lord, I pray, too, that you would show us ways that we can help the Japanese Christians to be more effective in reaching out to the Japanese population to bring them to faith in Christ. In particular, Lord, I pray that the leaders of the Christian community and churches in Japan would recognize the need to deal with the perception of Christianity as anti-intellectual and anti-scientific. Thank you for some of the breakthroughs I did see these past 3 weeks, and pray that they would continue, that those shackles would be taken off, and Lord, of the church there would really be set free to minister in a manner that they've never had before. Thank you for all the expatriates that have come into the country with a focus of bringing Japanese to faith in Christ, and pray you would bless their ministries. And Father, I pray for the church here in America.